guide. Don't expect me to play fair. Move in, I'll move even deeper in aside. I like you right there. I like you right there.
Welcome to Broadway Radios, this week on Broadway for Sunday, April 9th, 2017. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast today, we have a full panel. Peter Felicia is here. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, which is available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Masterworks, Broadway, Broadway Select, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
Good morning. Also with us is Jenna Tessa Fox. Jenna is a theater writer and reviewer whose articles have appeared online at timeatnewyork.com, playbill.com, broadwayworld.com, and newyorktheaterguide.com. Good morning, Jenna.
Good morning.
Good morning. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, Everything Sondheim, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You could see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Morning.
With us today, we have a very special guest. Tedra Milan is with us. Broadway fans will know Tedra from her Broadway debut in the current revival of Present Laughter, starring Kevin Kline, where she is just playing the awesome character of Daphne. So thank you so much, Teddy, for getting up on a Sunday morning in the middle of your crazy work week. You just opened up Present Laughter last week. And what is it like? You know, you are debuting on Broadway where a black stage happens and a curtain goes up and it's just you on the stage all alone for 5 minutes or so. So tell us, what did you think in your University of Michigan days that this was going to happen?
Oh, my God. It's very, very, very surreal. And thank you for having me on the show today. I'm happy to be here. yeah, life is pretty wild right now. Having a lot of laughs in Present Laughter land.
What did Noel Coward mean to you? Did you know Noel Coward from your days at the London Academy? Did you see Noel Coward plays on the West End, or was this the first time you ran into one?
Well, funnily enough, when I was a junior at the University of Michigan, my professor, Philip Kerr, brought me along with him one summer to, he was directing this show, Present Laughter, in upstate New York at this theater called Hubbard Hall. And I actually played Daphne Stillington there before. And that was my first professional show. So this show is very, very near and dear to my heart and kind of insanely perfect to be coming around to make my Broadway debut with it.
So, how wonderful.
I know Noel Coward pretty well now.
All right. Now, is your performance, because you're dealing with two different directors, substantially different now, or is it pretty much the same?
I'd say it's pretty different. One would hope.
Because?
Well,
what are you doing now?
I've completed undergrad and gone to grad school, and it's been several years later. But also just the way that we've gone about it. I mean, Noel Coward can be broad and it can be, you know, very over the top. And we kind of leaned into the broadness of it before. But Moritz's direction the whole time has really been about, these are grounded people who just end up in these wild, farcical situations. So I think the depth of the characters is really unique in our production.
Just last night, and I brought a friend, and I invited him, not knowing that it was his birthday coming up. And he, you know, we just both loved it. And he's like, this is the best birthday present you could ever have given me.
Oh, my God. That's so nice. Amazing.
All right. Now, here you are. I mean, a lot of young performers are somewhat scared to be performing with living legends. And you suddenly, there you are. You have to hold stage with Kevin Kline. How long did it take you? Was it minutes? Was it days before you were able to relax about this?
Honestly, I still can't relax. I can't believe that this is my life. But he's been so kind, and he's kind of just the ultimate dream to work with, because he just wants to play. And we get out there every night, and he is different every single night and fresh and new. And, you know, people have come up to me and said, is Kevin improvising? Is he just making up these lines? Because it sounds so fresh every single time. And I get to feed off of that. And it is different every time, because I have to give him back different things. And I don't know, it's just an incredible thing to be able to play with this legend and have so much fun with him. And he's so generous on the stage. You know, he just wants, you know, he's ready for anything.
Your first meeting with Kevin was at the final callbacks for Present Laughter. Tell us about that.
Oh my God. Yeah. So I got in the room, and he gave me a hug and said, you know, just to break the ice, you can touch me, you can go crazy, whatever you want. And so I was bending him over these chairs, and we were spinning around. He ended up lying on the floor, and I was standing over him. It was so much fun. But he's been so kind to me since day one, and I feel very, very grateful. And the entire cast, I mean, they're all these living legends. We have Kate Burton and Christine Nielsen and Red Rogers. I mean, Kobe Smulders, they're all these wildly talented, kind, generous humans that I just can't believe I get to play with them every night.
Well, on that note, I have to ask, and Peter probably was going to ask the same thing. I saw the production that George C. Scott did back in the day, in which Kate Burton played your role.
Uh-huh.
And so that's a really, you know, how wonderful to see her in the other role, and to see you in her role. And I'm of course wondering what kind of discussions you had about it.
You know, she has also not a single person in the cast has been cruel to me. They've been nothing but kind. And Kate at our first rehearsal came up to me and gave me a hug and said, you know, I play Daphne for my Broadway debut, and I can't wait to see what you're going to do. And she's been with me, you know, kind of through the whole thing, just checking in, giving me some nice positive assurance. And she's amazing. She's truly remarkable. And they're all these masters. But no, it's wild for the two of us having done it before. And we always talk about, she always brings up the George C. Scott version, and she showed me this picture the other day that she had taken, kind of the original selfie. She took it with this old camera in her dressing room mirror as her Daphne. So it's amazing to have her share these things with me.
If she hasn't already, I'm sorry, one last thing. If she hasn't already told you, make sure she tells you the story of what happened when she had to leave the show.
To leave the show.
She had to leave the show because she was cast by Ava LaGallien in Alice in Wonderland on Broadway. Did she tell you that story?
She told me about Alice in Wonderland. Yeah. But she tells me about having Nathan Lane be her Roland Maul, and seeing the two of them, you know, grow into what they are now. It's pretty wild.
Had you heard of her father? Did you know who her father was?
Oh, the unknown Richard Burton?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean.
All right, you're a young lady. You know, a lot of young people don't know about these things, so I'm wondering.
Oh, come on, give me a little credit.
Was there added pressure having Kate Burton there since she had done the role, you know, saying, "Oh my God, you know, is she judging me every step of the way and saying, no, that's not the way I did it. Good Lord."
I mean, hopefully she's not saying that under her breath. I really hope not. But no, she also, she is married to the stage manager from her production. So it's like this role, and she says that she still quotes like, "Hello, it's me," and different things come out. But no, she's been amazing and so supportive, and I'm very grateful for her friendship.
So let's talk about your, you went from the University of Michigan over to London to get your master's, and then you came back from London back to New York, and you did The Wolves last year. Let's talk a little bit about The Wolves. Tell us about what your experience was there.
Oh, God. The Wolves was... just a brilliant play at kind of the perfect time and with a cast of the most beautifully talented women and director and playwright. Just the whole beast of the thing was this perfect thing. I played number 46, who is the outsider. So that was... tricky because we started it last summer. I mean, there was an original workshop at Club Thumb, but I joined when we went up to New York Stage and Film in Poughkeepsie, and we all lived together in these two apartments next to each other to form this team. And then Lila Neugebauer, our director, would lead us every morning in a run, and we would go to the gym, and we would, you know, run around campus and have soccer drills for half the day. And then the other half of the day we were rehearsing. And I was the outsider, so I got to know the girls a little too well. But it just really, Lila always said, you know, when you sweat together, you just form this bond. And it's true that we just really formed this tight group. And we still have this group texting chat, and we're always texting, and we're all just so supportive of one another. And The Wolves are just so wonderful. And now we've been nominated for 2 Lucille Lortel Awards, which is pretty wild, for Outstanding Director and Best Play. So that's super exciting in Wolf World.
Huh. Now, the play was about soccer. Did you know anything about soccer when you started?
I did. I played indoor when I was younger, and I was the junior varsity captain when I was a sophomore in high school. But then I had to quit playing soccer to do the plays because, of course, you can't do theater and play sports in public high school.
All right. Now the question becomes, on your resume, when you were auditioning for The Wolves, did you put that you were the captain of the soccer team in your special skills category?
I actually didn't, because it said JV, so I was a little embarrassed. You know, to get the wrong impression. But no, we had to play soccer in the room for our audition, so.
I'll bet.
She knew. She knew it was up.
So, and then you, did you go on to The Flick before or after The Wolves?
The Flick was when I got back from London, so before The Wolves. So yeah, I understudied at the Barrow Street Theater for 6 months, and I started understudying Louisa Krauss, and then I got to understudy Nicole Rodenberg, and that was, I mean, that play is also incredible. I've been very, very lucky to be doing 3 amazing plays after another.
We've talked so often, it seems like almost every other guest that we have on Broadway Radio is from the University of Michigan, and we talk about the the Michigan Mafia. How has the Michigan Alumni Network, we won't call it the Michigan Mafia anymore, I got some nasty emails about that.
Did you really?
The Michigan Alumni Network, how has that helped you on Broadway?
Well, I mean, first of all, to have my professor bring me upstate to play this part originally is kind of a huge thing. But no, I run into my Michigan people all the time. The other night I went to Sardi's after a show, and Sass Goldberg was there from Significant Other. Darren Criss was there watching the show that night. We were all in school together. And so the Michigan, what's another word for mafia? Michigan
music. Family.
Michigan,
yeah,
Menches. Michigan Menches are going strong.
Yeah, that's nice. I like that.
You know, sometimes they call the mafia the Black Hand. We can call the Michigan, they could be the Blue Hand.
Blue Hand, right. Good.
There you go.
That's a good one.
Blue and Maize. what do you think attributes your how did you get into the room to have this audition for Present Laughter? How did that happen?
I had just finished the first run of The Wolves at the Duke, and I got an audition to tape for it. So I sent in this tape, and then Moritz called me into the room, and I had the initial audition, and then I got the call back, and that was with Kevin. And an hour after that, I was preparing for another audition, and I got a call saying that I was going to be on Broadway. So, and the rest is history.
Did you cancel that next audition? You're like, you know, I'm booked. I can't really do it.
I was so tempted to go to it because I loved it, but I had to cancel it.
So, you are coming into the crazy season in April and May and June of Broadway, and I know that you need to get your time to yourself, so we'll let you go. Tedra, thank you so much for joining us on a Sunday morning to talk about Present Laughter and what's going on. We really appreciate it. Listeners can get over to TedraMilan.com. We'll have links to that in the show notes as well as links to her Instagram account. And Tedra, thanks so much. Have a great morning.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Look out my window, there's a view of other windows, my own museum full of paintings. I look through where everything's clear. It isn't where I am, it's only where I'll go from here.
So all four of us got a chance to see Amelie. So, Peter, why don't you get us started on the Broadway production of the new musical of Amelie based on the movie?
Well, I haven't seen the movie, so I can't really say whether it's a good adaptation of the movie itself, which certainly was acclaimed, especially, however, for the actress playing Amelie, Miss Tattoo. I guess that's how you pronounce her last name, Audrey yeah. Tattoo. And so I'm looking forward to seeing the movie because it must have some sort of magic that the musical seems to lack. One of the things that I really have a problem with in any musical that appears on Broadway these days, and so many do, is the unit set. And when I saw that it was going to be a unit set, I was immediately disappointed. But I was more disappointed because the unit set is truly ugly. And for a show that takes place in Paris, it doesn't look as wonderfully Parisian as it should. Now, I don't need the Eiffel Tower in the background. I do not need people carrying grocery bags with a baguette coming out of it. I'm not saying that, but still, this looks so dour. Now, admittedly, Amelie's apartment is not terribly plush and posh, but still, the look of it is really quite dingy. Well, anyway, I wish that the show weren't dingy as well, but nothing worked for me whatsoever. Now, Philippa Sue got a nice round of entrance applause, which is a lovely thing to happen at such a young age, and with not that many shows behind her, but of course, one of them was awfully significant. So, and I begrudge her nothing, and she is perfectly decent in the role. Everybody, I think, is perfectly decent in what he or she is doing. It's the story of a girl who's raised by very protective parents, and I think that's part of the message of the show. Don't be so protective with your kids, because then you make them neurotic. Her father really believes that she's, not as healthy as she might be, and so he decides to homeschool her. And this also seems to be a cautionary tale about homeschooling. schooling, because it seems to indicate that if you don't have your kid around other kids, he or she is going to miss out on a great deal of socialization that is really quite necessary. What is nice about homeschooling, though, to be fair, is that it seems to activate imaginations, because the kid being denied a lot of contact with the outside world has to use her imagination to compensate for that. So she has a tragedy early on, too, and that's the fact that her mother is killed from a very strange situation, which I'm not going to give away. But that is a problem, and the father can't get over that, and we understand why. But so Amelie eventually leaves them and becomes a waitress, and now she's starting to learn about life a little. The eccentrics that come into the bar, you know, and but of course now the idea of romance comes in too. And needless to say, if she hasn't had much contact with people, is she going to be somebody who's going to have a lot of problems relating to people or being fooled by people who may very well not have her best interests at heart sexually? So ironically enough, the death of Princess Diana plays a great deal of in this show, and that may sound a little bit odd, but it really is true that that is a catalyst for a lot of things happening here. Anyway, I have a feeling I'm making it sound much more interesting than it is. It just isn't. It plods along. A decent cast, as I say, nothing extraordinary, but it makes no impact whatsoever. We have to give credit to the composer, because he certainly did not go for the cliches that we usually hear in French music. You don't hear the concertina that always shows up. So I do have to give credit to Daniel Massey. I guess that's how it's pronounced, for the music being different. The lyrics, he did some of them. So did Nathan Tyson, who was on Tuck Everlasting last year. Perfectly serviceable. And I don't know if Craig Lucas on the book improved or didn't improve the actual movie. So I have to do my homework and watch that. Maybe it's a little late to do homework, but anyway, a little after the fact, I'm going to certainly watch the picture and see if it has the magic that I did not find at the Walter Kerr Theater.
All right, Jenna, what did you think about this?
I largely agree. I did see the movie, and I love the movie. The movie is effortlessly charming and whimsical, and this musical is working so hard to be charming that you can hear its muscles straining. And I really agree with you, Peter. In the movie, when she sets out to start helping people, it's all very bright and there are smiles, and we see immediately how happy she's making people as she begins stepping into their lives. But what we also begin, you know, later to see the messes that she also makes and how things don't always go according to plan. Here, in a much shorter time frame, she seems much less helpful than just meddlesome. And her efforts to make people's lives better are, it's almost more irritating than beneficial.
Well, you know, that's kind of interesting to me, because I love shows where people are nice to each other. It's one of the reasons why I love Me and My Girl. It's one of the reasons why I love Come From Away. And I would think that I would respond to this, because she is trying to do a lot of good. But you, Jenna, I agree. Meddlesome is really the way it turns out to be. Mm.
And I think that's a major weakness in it. And I have no idea how to fix that weakness, because I don't remember that from the movie. In the movie, she carefully looks around, sees what she can do, steps in, makes her move, and then steps back. And, you know, in the beginning, we see everything going nicely. And then later we begin to see the snowball effect, that in some cases she winds up helping more than she hurts. But it doesn't seem meddlesome in the movie, or at least it's been a while since I've seen the film. I don't remember it seeming that way. And here, maybe it's just because it's a narrower time frame. It's 90 quick minutes, a nice, tight, intermissionless show. But it just didn't seem nearly as helpful. Also, I think the show suffers from young Frankenstein syndrome, with trying to find famous moments from the movie and fit them in, even if they aren't theatrical. And if they don't fit in the musical, we still have to have them because the audience expects those moments. Mm. So there's a scene in the movie where she's trying to help out her neighbor who works as he's developmentally disabled and works at a grocery stand, and he's being abused by his boss. So she begins stepping in to gaslight the boss and get the boss to stop being such a jerk. And here we have one little song to set up the grocery assistant and his abusive boss. And then we never see them again. There is no arc for that story. They get a whole little song and then they disappear.
That's so interesting because I've not seen the movie and I was wondering what the hell was that scene?
That was it.
Yeah,
I'm so glad you explained that, but that makes sense. You know, your explanation of it makes sense that they're trying to fit this thing in that was in the movie.
Exactly. There's this whole long arc with those characters in the movie, and it's, you know, a fun arc to watch. But it also gets one of my favorite lines from the movie when she finally learns, you know, I think one of the show's taglines is "a voice is a terrible thing to waste." She gets her voice, and towards the end when she defends the clerk, and the vegetable stand, the guy, the owner, begins yelling at his clerk and says, you know, "Are you a vegetable inside? Are you as much of a vegetable as what we're selling here?" And Amelie turns around and snaps at him, "No one will ever accuse you of being a vegetable. Even artichokes have hearts." And I was waiting for that line. It's a great line. And I thought, how are they going to set that to music? That's a song right there. That sings. And nope, gone. Mm. And I think that's a weakness of the show. I don't know if they had trusted the material more, just tell the story rather than try to recreate the film. Maybe it could have been stronger. I don't know what they could have done. But I agree, the show is dramatically weak. It certainly tries, but it just doesn't pull it off. I've got to give the cast credit. I mean, Pippa Sue, I think, does a lovely job. Tony Sheldon in two fairly small roles. Mano Feliciano, always wonderful. Chandler Barat as her love interest. They all do some very, very nice work. So the cast is very strong and they work very hard, but I think the bones of the show just need to be, I don't want to say they're broken, but they still need to grow.
All right, Michael, what did you think?
Well, I agree with every word that everyone said. As far as entrance applause, excuse me, I don't know if this happened when any of you guys saw the show, but when I saw it, the entrance applause was actually gotten by Savvy Crawford, who played young Amelie. I mean, and then Philippa Sue also did get applause separately when she came on, but people thought it was Philippa Sue at the beginning because I think Savvy Crawford comes on. I think she has a book in front of her face or her hat over her head or something like that. And people recognize the costume and they're like, oh, it's Philippa Sue. And then she wasn't. So that was kind of weird. And it reminded me of that strange thing in the front page where everyone thought Jefferson Mays was Nathan Lane. And it's really kind of embarrassing. But I think they could have reworked that. I did see the movie. And my experience there is kind of odd. I remember absolutely loving the movie, but I remember almost nothing of it. And I think that's maybe because of the, you know, it's such a light movie. And not in a bad way, but it's... You know, it's very light. It has that wonderful, ineffable French tone to it. And I think that is the main problem here. I think it's so difficult to try to translate that to a Broadway musical, especially a modern day Broadway musical where, you know, so often we feel that everything has to be so big and loud. I don't think that they were successful at all, even though I think some of the score in itself is actually fine, but the whole package, it doesn't really work. And I don't know, I have to say, why they thought of Pam McKinnon to direct this is kind of beyond me. Now, of course, you know, just because someone is known for a certain type of thing doesn't necessarily mean they can't do a different type of thing. But I don't know. I mean, her credits are she's a wonderful director. Her credits include China Doll, The Heidi Chronicles, A Delicate Balance, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, Clybourne Park. I'm just not sure why she was thought of as the person to go to for this. And I think perhaps if someone else had been directing, that might have made a difference in itself. I think they made a couple of tremendous mistakes in trying to use things from the movie. Two that leapt out at me was in the first act, there's a I guess it's a goldfish in a bowl that becomes a character. And I think it was a huge mistake to make that character an actual actor in a goldfish suit. Similarly, I think it was another awful, horrible mistake to make the gnome in Act Two. There's a subplot of a garden gnome that Amelie winds up sending to various points on the globe as a sort of a way to get her father out of his funk. And I think that, correct me if I'm wrong, I think that became a thing in real life, didn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, where people started to do that in real life. Well, here again, the gnome is played by a person, an actor in a gnome suit. And both the actor in the gnome suit and the actor in the goldfish suit, they look so strange and off-putting in just the way they look. That was a mistake in itself, and I don't think it worked. I thought it would have been much funnier if they just kept the gnome as an actual gnome and, like, had it appear in different places around the stage. So little and not so little mistakes like that. I also didn't think, although the audience loved it, I thought the Elton John number, I just didn't like it at all. And I thought too much time was spent on that. So I'm not sure if this was if this project was doomed from the start, from the conception, but whatever. I do not think it turned out successfully. One final comment, though, for whatever reason, I felt like whenever Adam Chandler Barat was on stage that the show worked. So I don't know if it's a combination of his material being better or that he just had something about his performance that he clicked into the style, whereas others did not. But I really did think that. So I have to really tip my hat to him for that.
By the way, given that you mentioned the irrelevancy of the Elton John number, I'm reminded that one of the biggest laughs of the night was when she turned on the TV and we saw a bit of Friends. The audience really laughed at that and enjoyed that tremendously. And when you have to rely on something like that to get one of your biggest laughs, you're truly in trouble. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say I predict no Tony nominations at all. Mm. Not one. And I think that will be the death knell. So if indeed you're the type of person who likes to see any and every Broadway musical, and we all know that such people exist, and I'm certainly one of them, I would say get there sooner rather than later.
No, I'd like to jump in and just say I do appreciate the efforts of Daniel Massey and Nathan Tyson and Craig Lucas to create a show that's not sarcastic or ironic. There is no... there's no darkness to the show, or very little darkness. And I genuinely appreciate the efforts to have, you know, no irony, and to have something that's genuinely about nice people trying to do nice things for one another. And I hope that the show's weaknesses don't turn other writers and creative people away from similarly themed shows of nice people doing nice things, that they don't feel the need to include sarcasm and irony and tragedy.
And you know what? I predict that if this show does have a life beyond Broadway and is done in much smaller situations, much smaller productions, I predict that those productions will be better than this one.
I could see that.
Yeah.
I really could.
So I don't want to belabor the point. I agree with everything that the three of you have said so far. What is interesting to me is how this show has had a lot of development to it, how it has kept on moving forward to this point. And I think that what they're seeing is that a very talented and charming Philippa Soo has blinded everybody to what are the underlying flaws of this show. Especially when you're so close to a project, you no longer see those things any longer. Yes. And they keep moving forward. And I think to myself, if you took Philippa Soo out of this role and just put a generic person into it who could be wonderfully talented. There are many, many actresses in New York that could play this role, but would this have kept moving forward without Philippa Soo's, you know, meteoric rise in the last couple of years? That wonderful article in New York Times on Philippa Soo. Did you guys see that about how she was the original Natasha Pierre? She was in Hamilton, and now she's originating Amelie, and she is her star is burning white, bright, and hot right now. Would they have gone forward on this project without her?
I think that's a very good point, James.
Yes, and you know, one final thing. This show's pre-Broadway engagement was at the Amundsen. And there again, I think if it maybe had started at a place like ART or a much more intimate place, then I think that would have might have made a huge difference also, because here they felt they had to go big, big, big from the beginning. And I don't think it's that kind of a show.
All right, let's keep moving forward. Peter, you already talked about Miss Saigon, but Michael and I got a chance to see it since we've talked about it. So, Michael, why don't you give us your thoughts on Miss Saigon?
Oh, okay. Yeah, I can be fairly brief. I think I've gone on record and saying I really don't like the show itself. I think it's just, you know, really not. I think find the music pedestrian and the lyrics worse. And I think it's not worthy of the subject matter as compared to Madame Butterfly, which is, of course, I mean, of course, here we have the shift to Vietnam, which was such a tragedy for two nations. And I just don't like it. I don't think there's much point in my saying a lot further on that. I think overall, this was quite a good production. In the beginning, I liked the fact that they ramped up the violence. I think some of you mentioned this last week. I mean, I think it is important for us to realize how horrible it was for these people. And, you know, especially like including the prostitutes. And I thought they did a very good job of that at the beginning. But then I thought it started to get a little sledgehammery and it kept happening. And I wasn't actually surprised to see that, because I think this director did the same kind of overkill in his recent revival of Les Mis. So I have mixed feelings about the direction. I thought that both Eva Noblezada and John Briones were excellent. Especially John Briones, who it took me a little while to get into his performance. I had a tiny bit of trouble understanding some of his lines because he has a rather thick accent. But as it went on, I just thought he was spot on, and I think he got every aspect of that character. And to me, it was a revelation. Because let's see, is this true? Yes, the only person I have ever seen do it is Jonathan Pryce. And while he is one of the most talented actors in the world, I just didn't think he fit the part. Eva Noblezada, whom I had the pleasure of seeing when she won the Jimmy Award, the National High School Musical Theater Award. I'm sorry, I believe she didn't.
She did not win. Yes,
that's right. She was maybe one of the finalists, but
She finished second. Yeah.
Yes. Thank you. I have to keep remembering that. But anyway.
But she won.
But she won in the long term, didn't she? She was just great. Also, got all the nuances. I really, really did not like Alistair Brammer, who played Chris. I liked his acting, and I certainly liked the way he looked. I thought his voice was all wrong for the part, too tenory, too thin. I thought it had an annoying quality. I didn't think it fit his body or his character. And in fact, the first time he sang at the very beginning of the show, in that scene where so much is going on, the heat is on in Saigon, I heard the voice and I was like, who is that? And it took me a while to realize it was him. So I just didn't like him. And I'm not sure that it was absolutely necessary to bring this British person over here to play this very American character in this Broadway production of this Broadway transfer of a production that started in London. Two other things. I heard, I think, James, you commented on the sound and you said you had a problem with it. Here again, I guess we have to disagree. I thought it was one of the best sound designs I've heard.
I was thinking maybe it was just that evening.
Yeah, because I had trouble too. Yeah. James and I were there the same night. But I'll tell you this. I have heard from somebody else that he thought the sound design was terrific as well. So maybe it was just that night.
Well, I think we were all there on the same night. Didn't I see you there, James?
At Saigon? I don't think so.
All right. Yeah, no. You're right, no. Michael. Yes. I remember seeing you as I was exiting the theater itself. Yeah, you're right. Isn't that funny? So maybe we were in dead spots, James.
Interesting. I mean, it really has become clear to me that that is true. And maybe it shouldn't be true of a really good sound design, but there can be dead spots in theaters. Anyway, I was happy with it, and I was really thrilled by the fact that it wasn't over-amplified, because I hate that more than anything. One last thing I have to say, and I don't think anyone else has commented on this, but I think they cut a very important scene or moment from Act One. As I remember the original production, and maybe I'm just hallucinating, there was a very brief sort of scene in Act One indicating that that Saigon was falling and showing us that the Americans were evacuating. Now, of course, we didn't see the helicopter in Act One, but because that's saved for Act Two. But I definitely remember a scene of the Americans pulling out. And in this production, it's completely gone. One moment you see Chris and Kim together. Then I think the next thing that happens is that there's that number, what is it called? The
Morning of the Dragon.
Thank you. Yes. Then you see that. And then the next thing you see is Kim sitting alone in the room. And at first you're like, what's going on? And then eventually she makes it clear that Chris has left and it's been 2 or 3 years since he left, and which one of you guys commented on last week. But does anyone else remember that in the original production there was some kind of moment where you see the Americans leaving?
No, I remember just like you described it.
I don't. You know, you have that telephone number. The John, is it you, buddy? Listen to me. Segment right after he sings "Why God Why," which is sort of crazy and hectic. But I don't remember some sort of pull out type of thing, but
well, I sure do, because and the reason it sticks in my memory was because when I saw the show all those years ago, I thought, oh well, this is where the helicopter should be.
Yeah.
But when are we going to see it? And then of course they save it for Act Two because it's their big moment.
Well, we have to Peter? Send you to the Film and Television Archive to check it out.
Peter, do you
no. have any? No, and I've always had a problem with that scene. So I think, by the way, Michael, I think what you've done is added a great improvement to the show. I think they should have.
I swear to God, I remember it. Maybe it was just the staging of what was happening behind when John made that phone call to Chris.
Yeah.
There is a story that Clive Barnes was fired from the New York Times because he described a scene in the play, The Trip Back Down, that wasn't in the play. And he later said, oh, I must have been sleeping and dreamed that scene. So maybe that's since you don't like the Saigon, Michael, maybe you fell asleep and dreamed that scene
20 years ago or whatever.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Well, anyway, I maybe I'll see if I can find a bootleg of the original production, because I swear to God I remember that.
All right. So, Michael, it's interesting because I really would like to go back to the Lincoln Center recording of Saigon from back when was it? The 90s?
Lincoln Center?
The film and the archive.
I'm sorry. Yes. Toft.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it Lincoln Center? No, it's the New York City Public Library archive at Lincoln Center. That's what I mean. And read and see that, because I felt like there was a ton of lyric changes that did not make the show better. And I was wondering, am I misremembering this? And I have to go back and compare and contrast the two.
You're not misremembering, because there's been some publicity on that. And get this, I have a friend in Columbus, Ohio, who comes here to see a bunch of shows like once or twice a year. And he's actually coming to stay with me in a couple of weeks. And he is specifically not going to Miss Saigon because he heard about the lyric changes and he doesn't want to hear them.
Wow.
That's a purist.
Because he loves the show as it is, and he doesn't want to see and hear it.
He loves the show as it is, and you're letting him stay in your apartment. That's a good friend.
You have to be open.
You have to draw a red line somewhere, Michael.
Yeah.
So So I, as everybody has mentioned before, John Briones and Eva Novelzeta, I think, were great. I'm going to have to side with Michael on the Alistair Brammer. Peter talked about that he felt that Alistair was the best Chris he's ever seen. And
yeah, I liked him a lot.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. I really disliked him a lot. I just felt he along the lines of what Michael was saying was that he didn't sing the part well. He looks great. He looks right for the part, and we'll split the difference on the directorial stuff. I thought that the very much the darker beginning before the Dreamland sequence led to, and I'm wondering if it was directorial choice, changes made in the script, or if it was John Briones taking the engineer very, very dark versus...
Yes.
Versus Jonathan Pryce is taking the engineer kind of very, you know, much in a different direction. Both were great, but wow, it was it really led to a deeper story there that that this was a terrible thing that was happening.
What I loved about John Briones was that there were many times when he was very, very charming. And you could see how he, you know, but then he would turn on a dime and like be, you could see, oh, this is a really scary person and I should stay away from him.
Yeah. I mean, Katie Rose Clark as Ellen, Nicholas Christopher as John.
The Tui, I thought, had a beautiful voice.
Yeah. Devin.
Beautiful voice.
Ilaw.
Yeah.
And Rachel Ann Goh for Gigi. I mean, I think the cast is, you know, was really solid outside of my qualms with Alistair Brammer. Also the audience that we were there with was very receptive and very full. So as Peter mentioned when he reviewed it a few weeks ago, I wonder if it's going to outlast this announced limited run and extend for a little while. I expect it will be around, just sort of like when Newsies first came onto the scene for 99 performances only. And and then we saw Newsy for a few years. So
on the other hand, it is a huge theater and there is so much competition. So I would be also interested to see if it does wind up extending.
Yeah. I think it's got decent word of mouth, and we'll have to see. And it feels like it's the 90s again with Sunset
yeah.
Boulevard, Miss Saigon, Sunday in the Park, and things like that. Not that that's bad. So Saigon has an announced closing date of January 13, 2018. Okay, the four of us got a chance to see the play That Goes Wrong over at the Lyceum Theater. So, Michael, why don't you start us off with that?
I loved it. I do think this is one of those cases where I would say, to me, maybe only two-thirds or three-fourths of the jokes in the show were funny. But since there are a million jokes in it, that's still a lot of laughter. There were some things that did not work for me. This is basically about the regional, fairly small time production in England of a murder mystery that's going horribly wrong from the first moment through the curtain call. This very intrepid troop that's trying to soldier on despite disaster, technical disasters, and every other possible kind of disaster you could think of. The cast is brilliantly talented. The direction by Mark Bell is phenomenal. The show is written by Henry Lewis, Jonathan Sayre, and Henry Shields. I think it will be doubly funny or triply funny to anyone who's ever done theater, but you don't have to have, you're still going to get it. One part I didn't think worked was that at one point, two women wind up on stage playing the same role because one of them had been knocked out and the stage manager, I guess, is enlisted to come on stage and do the role with a script. But then the other one comes too, and she comes on and then they have a fight on stage. And I didn't think that was funny at all because it just seemed mean-spirited. But most of the rest of the stuff was really just about technical screw-ups and things of that sort, and they all handled it brilliantly. There was one moment where there's a raised platform that's supposed to represent an upstairs room, and at one point that starts to collapse slowly, and I have to say that took me out of it a little bit just because it looked so dangerous that I was really kind of really worried about that. And in fact, I don't know the details, but somebody told me that they heard that that one of the actors was injured during a preview rehearsal.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, really? I hadn't heard that, and I don't know the details, and I guess it wasn't serious, thank God. But yeah, that kind of that was a little scary to me. But it's so well done, just overall very delightful. If you do go, try to get there a little early because there's some pre-show stuff with the company going through the audience, looking for, well, among other things, they're looking for a dog that's supposed to be in the play that never shows up. And interestingly enough, I just saw a little bit of business. I was seated in the orchestra, but a friend of mine who was in the mezz said that there was a lot of pre-show stuff going on up there, including actors like jumping over seats trying to find the dog. So this might be a situation where you'd be just as well, if not better off, in the mezz as in the orchestra.
All right, Jenna, what'd you think about this?
I largely agree. I laughed a lot. I did not think. Yeah, I agree about 3/4 of the jokes landed, but I completely agree with Michael. When you've got that many jokes, 3/4 is more than enough. Right. It's a very funny evening. And anyone who has ever done community theater or, any kind of theater can certainly connect and appreciate. Sort of similarly to Amelie, I really like that this is about people, as far as we can tell, good people just struggling against unfair odds and they're soldiering through. Though I also agree about the two women fighting, that really took me out of the overall positive vibe as we're rooting for these characters to get through this play and for it to come out as good as possible. By and large, everyone is focusing on making this play work. They're all focused on the community effort and they're working together as the set is literally collapsing around them to keep moving forward. But that moment is about selfishness.
Yes.
And they're not focusing on the common goal. They're focusing on, I want to be the star right now.
Right. Yeah, I really felt that moment came out of nowhere. And really, I'm surprised that they didn't realize that it shouldn't be in there, because you're absolutely right. That's the problem. That's exactly, you've hit the nail right on the head.
Yeah, they're all working together all throughout the show. And, anyone who's ever been on stage and had to shoot warning looks at one another, you can recognize the looks they're giving each other to try to warn one another, don't step over there, look out for this. And they're always looking out for one another, except for those two characters in that moment when suddenly they aren't. It rang really false to me. And I think that was a misstep in the overall creation of the show. Inevitably, this is going to draw comparisons to Noises Off, and not unfairly. I think I would have to say, though, where one element that Noises Off gets better than this piece is that we see the actors as actors, not necessarily as the characters they're playing. And so we have more of a reason to root for them to get through the show. Here, we never see them, or hardly ever see them, breaking character. They are always doing this performance. It's like just act 3 of Noises Off gets dragged out for a 90-minute play. So I kind of miss seeing the backstage drama to see what's going on to bring them to this moment as everything is collapsing around them, and knowing what's happening with the actors as actors, not the actors as characters. But that's a minor quibble. By and large, this is a very funny evening at the theater. There's very little that would not be inappropriate for kids. A woman runs around in some lingerie. There's one semi-homophobic moment, but beyond that, it's a very funny show that a lot of families could see and appreciate, and really enjoyable.
Yeah, I was saying that to my wife that we could have brought our kids to this and they would have had a lot of fun. Peter, what did you think about this?
I liked it more than both of you guys, because I would say that at least 85 to 90% of it was hilarious. And yes, in anything like this, there are going to be longers and there are going to be things that you don't find funny. Frankly, the scene that you're objecting to didn't rub me the wrong way, because I thought by that point in the play, people are so frustrated with everything going wrong that any type of decorum would be and civility would be tossed aside by that point. And I think that's quite real. So I didn't have a problem with that you guys did. I laughed continuously, and then there'd be a couple of minutes where I didn't. But for the most part, my God, what I really loved about this and respected this play for is whenever I said, where are they going? What could happen next? Something happened next that I hadn't. They got it all. Any type of disaster you could possibly think of, they thought of every one of them. And I'm really very impressed by that, that they kept it going. I had seen half of this play in London, because very few shows in London play on Sunday afternoons. And I was leaving London Sunday evening. And the hotel I was staying at was virtually across the street from the theater where this was playing. And I said, okay, I will go and see an act. And I was very disappointed that I had to leave. But for a year and a half now, I've been saying to myself, gee, I wonder what they could have done. They really covered every base. Yes, that's my limited imagination that they covered every base. They certainly did cover more bases than I could have ever conceived of. So I was very impressed. And when I left the theater, I also saw a flyer for their next show, which was called Peter Pan Goes Wrong. Now, two thoughts come immediately to mind there, and that is the fact that I have seen on America's Funniest Home Videos many sequences involving amateur productions of Peter Pan, and my friend Paul Roberts is still talking about the one he saw 20 years ago in a community theater in Massachusetts, where Peter Pan was not flying horizontally but vertically, and the actress finally was screaming, put me down! Put me down! So I think Peter Pan Goes Wrong has a lot of potential, and I hope that the play that goes wrong does well enough that we get Peter Pan Goes Wrong too. So, and the thing about kids, yeah, one of my readers is a 9-year-old child, and I've got to know his mother, and I'm writing her and saying, you've got to take him to this. I think he'll have just a wonderful time, and you will too. So wow. I recommend this wholeheartedly, and I hope I haven't seen it for the last time.
I really enjoyed it as well. I don't know if it was just hit me at the right time, but I can't think of any other shows on Broadway right now that are this type of genre of show, and I had a tremendous time at it, and I really enjoyed it. Michael, I looked up to see if somebody was injured in the play that goes wrong recently, and it's ambiguous here, because I'm confused if it's marketing or if it's something that actually happened. But it seems like the actor Henry Shields was injured on March 30th. He had a minor injury on stage during the show, although I'm not sure if this is actually part of their marketing effort that where, like, if you go to Times Square, they're, you know, $100,000 a week sign that's hanging in Times Square is upside down. And it's, you know, certainly that's on purpose. The marquee is upside down as well, and things like that. Sure. So I don't actually know if Henry Shields got injured or not, but he seems to be fine if he was injured. So
that would be funny if my friend also fell prey to the marketing who told me, oh, you know, one of them got injured.
And let me address the noises off issue, because I think it's a very fair one. And so many times when I've talked to people about this show, they their eyes narrow and turn to slit. And they say in a bored voice, oh, you mean it's the third act of Noises Off? Well, yeah, it is. But on the other hand, you can look at it this way, and I'm not saying that everybody should, I'm not saying everybody will, but in a strange way, I was very happy to be liberated from the problems of those actors and just see the disasters. Whatever that says about me, fine. Mm. You know, but not having the backstory of who these people were was rather freeing for me. So I could just enjoy the chaos that was going on.
I can see both points, and I hope I didn't overstate the, you know, I mean, it's almost consistently funny from the first moment to the last. It's just there are, as you say, Peter, there are a couple of moments where
have to be.
Yeah. And I guess just the thing between the two actresses playing the same role, it didn't bother me. I think it bothered me because it just partly because it seemed so unrealistic that with everything absolutely going to hell around them, that their main concern would be which of them is going to stay on stage and continue doing the role. Maybe that was it, but whatever. It's a delightful evening. I also wholeheartedly recommend it. And it's something that I think is very much needed at this time in our lives.
Very true. But I also think one element that bothered me about the two women fighting is the cliche that women can't work together, that women are always competing with one another. And this, you know, throughout the entire show, everyone is working together. They are a team. They are dedicated, and you know, they are always supporting one another, except when the two women are suddenly on stage together and now they're competing. And yeah, that just bothered me.
Yeah. I could see that point of view, and I guess if the guys had done it, we would have certainly complained about the fact that there are so many personalities and egos in theater that we would have minded that as well. But you're right, Jenna, they did choose women, didn't they? They had the chance to choose men, but they chose women, so I see a point there. And while we could argue that there's a show down the street where two women aren't getting along either, a new musical on 41st Street, they're after all not working together, so there
exactly.
is a difference there, right?
So that's an excellent transition into our next topic. Peter, you got a chance to see War Paint over at the Nederlander Theater. So why don't you tell us what is happening at War Paint?
Well, when I first heard reports from Chicago that the ladies didn't meet until the end of the show, that really surprised me because I certainly thought that both Helena Rubinstein and Elizabeth Arden would have met and had a lot of things to say to each other. And that sounded like a mistake to me, and yet the tension that builds up when they finally do get together at the end of the show works extraordinarily well. However, there's got to be something wrong with a musical where the applause does not come in a show-stopping applause way until the sixth number of the first act, when two old pros finally sing and really overwhelm the house. And the problem is, it's not the two ladies. It's not Patti LuPone and Christine Ebersole who get that show-stopping applause. It's John Dossett and Douglas Sills who get it. Now, wow. Why is this happening? Well, for one reason, I blame Michael Greif totally for this show not being better than it is. I think the pace is funereal. I don't think there's tension in the air as much as there should be. And this show should really crackle like a drive-by shooting, and it really doesn't. And one of the problems, too, is that he has not really established applause buttons for the ladies early on. Those songs just meld into each other, segue into each other too often without applause buttons. Now, I think this is a tremendous mistake in any musical because I really believe, and this is my theory and my theory alone, I've never heard anybody else say it, and it could be way off base, and I'll concede that point right away. But I truly believe that if you have a musical where you don't let the audience applaud early on, subconsciously, it really starts to believe that the show isn't that good because nobody's applauding. Mm-hmm. I think you really have to get the audience applauding right away and make it a hot house under those circumstances. Mm-hmm. I really believe this is one of the big problems with Merrily We Roll Along, because after that, I don't mean The Hills of Tomorrow, but after the Merrily We Roll Along number, I think we should have had an applause button right there, and I think it would have really set the tone for the evening of being an exciting evening, and it was exciting for us back then to see this new Sondheim musical. But instead, those of you who know the cast album, party! And they go into that sequence. This is a long time not to have the audience applaud, and I think it's a mistake in War Paint as well, not to have them do it. Both ladies are wonderful. No surprise there. Their songs, the melodies, I think, are really quite wonderful, and the lyrics are good, too. The orchestrations by Bruce Coughlin, I think, are really top-notch as well. So I have a feeling this is a show that's going to do better in community theater. Michael made a point about this earlier with a different show, and I think this may work better in community theater. Now, partly because you can cast two women who have known each other since day one one and have competed for the same roles since day one and hate each other since day one. And they could really go at it. You know, I mean, I understand Patti LuPone and Christine Nebisole are getting along extraordinarily well. That's what I hear. It doesn't make it true, but that's what I hear. So, and I'm not saying that's a problem for them on stage. Yeah, they snarl tremendously. But nevertheless, I have a feeling in community theater with the history of two actresses who loathe each other, it's going to be crackling better. And you'll have a director who will, you know, make it ferocious. It's just so lackadaisical in the direction. So let me also say, I didn't know anything about this story, and I was really, really fascinated to hear whether it's true or not that both of the men in their lives switched sides, that one went for the earth to the other and the other vice versa. And that is a tremendously interesting complication. However, I lose a little respect for these business women because they should know that you've got to keep your enemies closer, as they say. And the idea of losing a valued employee because you don't want to give credit or you don't want to give too much power to that person. Yes, I understand we're in different times. I understand that women are trying to make their lives in a man's world. That's tough, no question, especially then. So, but they seem to make mistakes that I wish they didn't make. And perhaps the point of the show is that these pioneering women made mistakes so that today's business women don't make them, that they learn from those mistakes. It's entirely possible that's what they were going for. I also wonder about Doug Wright's decision to have information conveyed by both of them going to the St. Regis and not meeting each other. They're in adjoining banquettes, and they overhear what the other is saying, and that's the way to each finds out something about the other. It happens once in Act 1, where one person hears what the other is saying, and it happens once in Act 2, where the reverse happens. And, you know, that's awfully convenient. I really don't like shows where people walk in at the wrong time and find out something they shouldn't find out. This is a variation on that, so I found that a little problematic. Now, again, direction here. When the ladies leave, they don't see each other. I'm not sure if it's a case where they don't see each other or they do see each other and pretend they don't see each other. But the fact that I don't know that for sure, again, indicates the problem in the direction for me. So a lot of assets in Wasp Paint. I'm sure it's going to have a lot of fans. I'm sure it's going to have a lot of business. You cannot help having business with those two women in it. But I'm looking forward to that community theater production in the future.
All right. Michael, a couple of weeks ago, you were down in Washington, D.C., where you got to see Ragtime at the Ford's Theater. So why don't you tell us about that?
It was absolutely magnificent. Directed by Peter Flynn, whose work I know primarily and I think only from – he used to direct the shows when the Actors Fund would do full musicals as benefits. They did that fabulous On the 20th Century with Maren Mazzie and Doug Sills, and they did Chess and a few others. And he directed all or most of those, and those were all great. So I don't think I've seen his work since. I'm not sure if he still is based in New York, but he directed this great production of Ragtime, which shows that a director can make a show like that, a classic show, their own without distorting it completely in the way that people like Sam Gold and Ivo Van Hove. So I can't say enough about how great Peter Flynn's direction was. And I have an acquaintance in the cast, Greg Mayhew, who plays Mother's younger brother brilliantly. And he also, that was the first thing he said about the show when we spoke with him afterwards, that the director was great as a director, but also in terms of dealing with the cast. And he just really loves him. So I wish him a really continued fabulous career. Everything about the show was wonderful, and to see it at Ford's Theater, which is so historic, especially since a great deal of the story is about civil rights and equal treatment for African Americans, the resonance was unbelievable. And Cole House was played by Kevin McAllister, whom I had seen as the sheriff in 110 in the Shade at the same theater, and he was wonderful in that. But that's that role isn't nearly as powerful and central as this one. He was superb as Colehouse Walker, and so was Nova Payton as Sarah. Too many standouts. I can't name everyone. But Tracy Lynn Olivero was as mother was wonderful. And it this show goes through May 20th. And I'm telling you, I've said this before, but I'm planning on going back and buying a ticket to see it again, because every production I've seen of Ragtime has been excellent, but this was maybe the best one of all. And here again, I think this is another case where, as magnificent as the original production was at whatever that theater is called, I think that something was lost in the hugeness, the vastness of that space. Comparatively, Ford's Theater is much more intimate, and even though the show is big in a way, I mean, it has a large cast and it deals with epic themes, there is an intimacy that was absolutely there in this production that was not in the original production at the – well, actually, it was called the Ford Center, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. When Ragtime played there on 42nd Street, it was called the Ford Center. So, and now it's at Ford's Theater in D.C., and it's a much better experience. And just quickly, the other show I saw in D.C. was a new musical called Midwestern Gothic at Signature. And I was looking forward to this for several reasons, primarily because it has music by Josh Schmidt, who wrote the music for one of the most haunting, most unforgettable, unique musicals I've ever seen off Broadway. The Adding Machine. The musical is just called Adding Machine, based on The Adding Machine by Elmer Rice. And there's a recording of that. If you'd like to get it, it's just very, very distinctive and I would say unique treatment of that music. Property. Midwestern Gothic is, as it sounds, it's a story about a kind of a backwoods, very rural setting, and there are all these dirty doings and a lot of sex and a lot of violence. The interesting thing here, it's not a southeastern backwoods setting. It's Midwestern, and I'm not sure exactly where it's supposed to be set. I'm not sure if they said, but the accent sounded like they were in, like, I don't know, Minnesota or North Dakota or somewhere like that. But again, a very strong cast, including Timothy J. Alex, whose work I know from here in New York, and Bobby Smith. To very briefly, the main plot is about this kind of Lolita type, very, very, very sexy young woman played by Morgan Keene. And she's living with her stepfather, which, you know, already we see that there's going to be a problem there because her mother is absent. Her mother's still alive, but she's not living with them and she's working a lot. Or maybe she's living with them, but she's never there because she works so much. And so lots of sexual tension, and that leads to horrible violence. And they do great, great work at Signature in both their revivals and their new musicals. So that's another thing to put on your list of something that to try to catch.
All right. So again, a very fruitful trip down to the DC area for you. We should all put that in our rotations. Such great things. In fact, my wife and I are such big fans of Ragtime that we're trying to figure out how to get down to the Ford's Theater to go see it.
Ironically enough, there's that expression, if it ain't on the page, it ain't on the stage. And I have to agree with Michael. I've seen 9 different productions of Ragtime, and I've never seen a bad one either. And I have a feeling it has to do with the fact that the work is so wonderful itself that it inspires people to do their best work.
I completely agree.
All right. Michael and Jenna got down to the Public Theater to see Latin History for Morons. So, Jenna, why don't you start us off with that?
Thank you. John Leguizamo's latest monologue. It examines, yes, he does so many of them, and he does them so well. This monologue examines not just the history of Latinos in the Americas and all the way across the Americas, but the effect of the denial of that history has had on the Latin community. The story has an arc following Leguizamo's son, who is trying to write an essay on a hero. So Leguizamo begins searching for a Latin hero who can inspire the next generation of Latino kids. Mm. And as he does his research, he begins learning more and more about the role of, you know, the Latin history in South America, Central America, North America, and the effect of history on not just how it creates this Latin culture across a huge geographic area, but also the effect of colonial and post-colonial oppression and the effect that's having not just on a culture, but on individuals, when you're denied representation and respect, people see themselves as helpless and hopeless. And he attributes that to a lot of problems in the Latin American community and backs it up with a lot of really interesting facts. Naturally, Leguizamo being Leguizamo, he treats all of this with a lot of humor, sometimes borderline offensive humor. I mean, there's some moments that sort of veer on the homophobic, but he keeps insisting his brother is gay, his uncle is gay, so he's allowed to make jokes poking fun at the gay community. I have no lines in that scene, so I'll shrug that one off. But the play has a lot of brain and heart to go along with the laughs. It makes its point very, very well about the need for representation, about the need to celebrate a very accomplished history, and the need for representation, to see Latin people as heroes, not just as victims, and not to treat an entire culture and community as caricature. And I think it makes its case in a very engaging, amusing way, as only John Leguizamo can do. At one point, he's talking about meeting with his therapist, and he says, "My therapist sounds a lot like Garrison Keillor," and then launches into an instant Garrison Keillor impression as he sits there, he's the only person on stage, but having a conversation with himself about how the lack of representation makes him feel. And it's this fantastic moment, but because he's doing a Garrison Keillor impression, it's hilarious at the same time as it's enraging, because you realize the long-term effects of the lack of representation. But he can make you laugh as you're learning something, and that's a great skill. And I hope he keeps doing more monologues about the history. I love his monologues about his personal history, but I love this look at broader cultural impacts and a celebration of culture and history in a really amusing way.
Michael, what did you think?
I loved it. I haven't seen John Leguizamo do something like this in many years. And unless I missed it, I don't think there has been one, at least maybe not in New York. It seems to me the last one was quite some time ago. So it was so great for me to see it again. I think he's working with someone new in Tony Taccone as his director, and that seemed to work very well. The show was very well done, very simple, but very well staged. John he's supremely talented, and one of his great talents is that he creates other characters at the drop of a hat, including I found his characterization of his son very, very touching.
Yes.
His son, of the elements of the plot is that his son is being bullied at school, and I thought that was all handled very well. He's someone who I don't think he's been doing this kind of thing for a while, and it's thrilling to me that he's back doing it, and I'm so glad that I saw it.
All right. So next up, Peter got over to New World Stages, where he saw Church and State. So Peter, tell us about this very serious comedy.
Well, you know, we're getting accustomed to intermissionless shows that run 90 minutes. And like it or not, there are people who really dislike the fact that they're paying so much money for so little time. That shouldn't be a value, I think, but we all have our values. And if that's the way you feel, you're going to be angry at Church and State, which I think may not even be an hour. And maybe it should be longer, given the fact that it deals with a politician who finally decides to tell the truth about how he feels. And it's going to cost him quite a bit. I think this is a more complex subject than the playwright is allowing it to be. So it seems to me what we have here is a condensed play that should have been two acts or at least 90 minutes, so we could have learned more about these politicians' feelings. What he's really talking about more than anything else is religion. And Lord knows, no pun intended, that there's a lot to talk about in religion, and why the playwright talked about so little of why this man is feeling what he's feeling struck me as just the tip of something that wasn't remotely an iceberg and should have been an iceberg. So I wish I could be more enthusiastic about this, but the fact is that I felt like I was getting an appetizer when I should have had an entree as well as a dessert.
Mm. Now I'm hungry.
So am I. I'm always hungry. But that's
almost lunchtime.
Yeah. Michael, you got a chance to see the ongoing series, this one, the Broadway Musicals of 1940. So tell us about that.
Well, obviously, that is a great decade to sample, and it was a wonderful concert at Town Hall, part of the Broadway by the Year series, created, written, directed, and hosted by Scott Siegel, music director, piano, Russ Patterson, and a wonderful little band. We had Ben Davis, Daniel Reichard, Karen Ziemba, Clea Blackhurst, Kendrick Jones, Leslie Margarita, and a couple of other great people doing songs from Oklahoma, South Pacific, Finian's Rainbow, Cabin in the Sky, Kiss Me, Kate, and Panama Hattie.
I had a feeling we'd hear that. You're on the scene, yeah.
Yeah, she's become famous for her Merman tributes, and deservedly so. So it was just a wonderful show. And I wanted to mention, please, if you have the night free, put on your calendar Monday, May 1st, because that is the evening of Broadway Unplugged at Town Hall, which gives you a chance to hear lots of wonderful people singing with no amplification whatsoever, which is something we rarely get to do anymore.
That sounds really good. You know, we keep talking about Scott Siegel and these series. They're just wonderful. I meant to ask you last time, is anybody recording these, either video or audio?
Well, you know, it's funny you mentioned that. I know that they were recording them, and in fact, I have a whole set of them. I don't know if they stopped or if I just stopped asking and getting them. And of course, even if they're not issuing them commercially, they may still be recording them archivally. So that is an excellent question, which I will ask Scott.
Yeah, let us know about that. Because I know that a lot of listeners would love to at least hear or see these on video that they can't get into New York, especially for the one night only concerts for listeners around the world. So maybe they could hear or listen to these through some other means. Jenna, you were down at the Public seeing Gently Down the Stream, so tell us about that.
Yes, this is the latest play by Martin Sherman, who's probably most famous for Bent. Mm. Similarly, this also looks at the history of gay men in the past. This story follows two gay men, or several gay men, I should say three, from different generations. One, an American who fought for civil rights, and one, a young man 40 years younger than the other, who takes those rights for granted because he grew up in the world that the other one created. So the play imagines whether or not these two men from different worlds can really connect on an intellectual level, and the scenes of their relationship changing over the course of 13 years is interspersed with monologues by the older man, Beau, played by the amazing Harvey Fierstein, about his own life and the violence and oppression that he faced from the 1960s through to the AIDS era. And Gabriel Ebert plays his younger lover, Rufus, who's got his own emotional baggage and honestly, Rufus is a much less compelling character, but Gabriel Ebert does a beautiful job of making him compelling, even though he's really not given terribly much to work with. That, I think, is the play's biggest problem, that the lovers are unevenly matched, so their love story is not all that compelling. The monologues that Harvey Fierstein delivers, they are the real highlight of the play. And learning about Beau's past and seeing how it affects his present is incredibly powerful, really thrilling. He talks about meeting and working with activists and allies like Larry Kramer, James Baldwin, Judy Peabody, and he talks about all the sacrifices these people made for, you know, everything that we take for granted today. Rufus takes equality for granted, but Beau only sees, you know, this is the ravages of war. Mm-hmm. And at one point when they're bringing up equal marriage rights, Beau has a line to the effect of, but we're supposed to be outlaws. And the idea of legalization of equal marriage doesn't connect with him. He doesn't understand it because it's so far removed from everything he had to fight for that he doesn't understand it. Fierstein is, I mean, to absolutely no one's surprise, an absolute powerhouse as Beau. He's a New Orleans-born expat living in London. I'm not an expert on accents by any stretch, but it sounded like he really got the New Orleans twang down right, except in a few bits where any word had the ER sound in the middle, like color or purple, that he always put in the very Brooklyn oi sound. circle or purple. That was the ones I noticed. Soikle, poiple. Those popped up a few times, and they even referenced it. You sound like you're from Brooklyn, which was very amusing. The set of the play is also fantastic. I've got to give a shout out to Derek McLean for that. Beautiful work creating a lovely London flat covered with books and memorabilia. It is a lifetime in one room, and really presented very nicely. Sean Mathias' direction, a little slow at some points, but by and large, very smooth and very gentle. It eases you into the horror of the past. Really, it's like the frog being boiled alive and doesn't realize the water's getting hotter and hotter. Sean Mathias just eases you into these horrifying stories until you suddenly realize where they're going, and you don't realize how terrifying it is until Harvey is really going into the details of what he suffered through. And it's just chilling and so powerful. So definitely a play worth seeing. This is a play, you know, very appropriate for teenagers on up. And it's, again, a one act, 100 minutes. I really hope parents will bring their teenage kids, go out to, you know, Soup and Burger across the street and then talk about it for a long time afterwards. This is something that I think the next generation needs to understand about the sacrifices, about the devastation of the AIDS era, about the years where, you know, the Stonewall era, where bars could be raided, people could have their lives destroyed just for being in a bar. I mean, how horrifying is that? But people accept that, you know, gay bars are everywhere. What's shocking about it? The idea that they were illegal and that you could be killed for stepping foot into a bar is so far removed from anything people, I would say, under the age of 40 have experienced, that I hope it really generates discussion and appreciation for everything that came before.
So, Peter, you want to give us a little recommendation on a show that is not often seen?
That's it. You know, I mean, so many times I hear people say, gee, I wish I could see every Tony-winning musical. And, of course, nobody's ever going to see Jerome Robbins' Broadway again or Fosse. Those are so specific. And it's very hard to see Redhead as well and Hallelujah Baby, the only musical that won a Tony that was already closed when it had won the Tony. But, you know, one that's really good that never gets done, it seems, is City of Angels. And I do think that you should take advantage of this if you want to see this magnificent show from the 1989-90 season, and it's going to be at the Blue Hill Troupe. Now, they're a group that's been around for a long, long time. They started off doing Gilbert and Sullivan, and they still do Gilbert and Sullivan, but every now and it seems like almost every year now they do a musical that is of a more recent vintage. So at the El Teatro of El Museo del Barrio, which is at 1235 Fifth Avenue, that's between 104th and 105th Street in New York, the troupe is going to do City of Angels by Larry Gelbart, one of our greatest humorists, Cy Coleman, one of our greatest composers, and David Zippel, who's a terrific lyricist, and I wish we could hear more of his work. So hear his terrific work and everybody else's from Friday, April 21st through Saturday, April 29th. So it's two weekends, a total of only five performances. Tickets are $30 to $110, and it's really a good deal because these it's a mixture of pros and community theater people usually. I don't know what this one will be, but I have been to their productions, and I've enjoyed them immeasurably, and I have a feeling that City of Angels is going to live up to their august reputation of having been around for a long, long time. So get over to 104th Street and make sure you see City of Angels, even if you've seen it before.
I love City of Angels, and I've always thought about, you know, why it doesn't happen here. And I think that possibly one of the reasons it doesn't happen is just the sheer scale of what you have to do with City of Angels. It's so expensive. Do you think that's a valid concern?
Oh, absolutely. Because what happens is some of it is in color and some of it is in black and white. And so as a result, you do need to deal with two different palettes, completely different palettes. I saw a production of Villanova some years ago that was very smartly done because what they did was use projections. And so as a result, you had the sets done by projections and therefore they were in color and black and white much easier. I don't know if that's what Blue Hill will do, but I'll tell you, if you're thinking of doing City of Angels, that might be a solution for you that'll save you a good deal of money. So I do believe that is, I agree with you, James. That's why we don't see it more often.
All right. So before we wrap up for today, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of Broadway Radio. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You listen to us in many ways. One of the ways is the iHeartRadio station. You can listen to us on TuneIn. You can listen to, you can get us from Google Play as well, Stitcher, and the lots of other places that you can get to listen to finer podcasts, as well as the Stitcher app. Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Jenna, for Peter, for Michael, and for me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today. So, Peter, do you have an answer to last week's trivia?
Yeah, well, the question was, if you remember in math, they used to give you analogies like 3 is to 6 is 4 is to what? And the answer is 4 is to 8. So I asked, Sondheim is to Sideshow as George Gershwin is to, and that was the question. It amazed me that more than a dozen people guessed Grey Gardens. And their logic was logical. They said, well, Stephen Sondheim, S.S., Sideshow, S.S., George Gershwin, G.G., Grey Gardens, G.G.
Ah.
Well, you know, all right, yeah.
I was one of those people.
Yes, you were, in fact. So anyway, you know, the thing is that when I was a teacher, I always used to say to the kids, what I'm looking for is the best answer. And, of course, that is subjective, I'll grant you. And maybe there are people who feel that Grey Gardens is a better answer than the one I'm going to give. So I say the answer is Sondheim is to Sideshow as George Gershwin is to My Fair Lady. Now, the question for this week, I'm going to ask you why. Only Carrie Winslow was the person who guessed what was on my mind and gave a good reason why it should be My Fair Lady. So see if you can figure that out for next week. That's the question. Why would it be My Fair Lady, which has really nothing to do with George Gershwin on the surface any more than Sondheim has to do with that Sideshow that was produced twice on Broadway already. But that's not really what I'm looking for. So I know I'm being purposely enigmatic, but see if you can figure out why it would be My Fair Lady.
All right. So if you know the answer to that, email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com, and we'll let you know if you're on the right track. So on behalf of Jenna Tessa Fox, Peter Felicia, and Michael Portantier, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.